Welcome to this podcast series asking the question, can art save us? I'm starting the first national and international conversation about courage and curiosity. What do these qualities really mean and why does it make a big difference to our mental, societal and democratic health? I talk to award-winning and diverse artists across the arts to explore these qualities in their lives and work, both to inspire and for us all to learn. I'm exploring why we need these qualities to help change the global epidemic of mental illness, loneliness, polarisation of our communities, and even global conflict. If the arts cultivate courage and curiosity, I'm asking the question, can art save us? Do you like dancing? Do we dance enough? Or maybe the question is, why don't we dance more? My guest today is not only an accomplished dancer and choreographer, but the UK's first professor of dance education, Dr. Angela Pickard. Angela has worked with talented dancers and choreographers across a multitude of theatres and sites, both in the UK and internationally. From toddlers to the Royal Ballet School, Angela has a wealth of knowledge, and she is currently the director of the Sydney Dehaene Research Centre for Arts and Health here in the UK. She's interested in the relationship between dance and psychological, social, and artistic outcomes. She's particularly interested in responding to exclusion, who is and isn't included in dance, even in contemporary forms that we might assume are much more accessible. Who participates in dance is problematic. There's a ring of elitism around it. Yet dance is recorded in some of the earliest cave paintings. So wasn't it always part of who we all are? Different generations may have memories of the traditional Friday night dance at the village hall, the school disco, the glamorous prom, the explosion of street dance, or maybe just at weddings. Have you ever been to a morning dance rave known as a daybreaker to feel energised and well? Are you a fan of the hit TV series Strictly Come Dancing? Whatever is happening, it seems our relationship with dance is fragmented, yet it has brought joy, protest, and phenomenal social change through the ages. So let's get curious about dance, and who better to ask than the UK's first professor of dance education. And hello, Angela. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, hello. What a wonderful introduction. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's such a pleasure to be able to explore different subjects and the arts through my guests. It's just such a lovely opportunity to keep learning. And I wondered actually, Andrew, if the best starting point was to really understand how you first engaged with dance. Maybe there's a first memory or the first time you were exposed to dance, but how come you became a dancer?
So I think it probably was because I was a very active child. I wasn't able to keep still. And my dad, in fact, used to call me Squiggle because I just could not keep still. And that was really why and how I think I got into dance, because it was about learning how to be still rather than movement initially. So I went along to ballet. And in that particular technique, there's, you know, a discipline in terms of understanding stillness as well as movement. So, and I think I loved that discipline in some ways because I was able to control and calm myself, perhaps for, you know, times when I hadn't really been able to do that before, because I found stillness very, very challenging. I have to say, even now, I find stillness quite challenging. But so I think that's probably how I began.
That's fascinating to immediately consider dance as equally being about stillness as it is about movement. That's absolutely fascinating. So I suppose that may feed into those wider benefits of not just physical training, but perhaps mental training as well. Would you say that's fair to say?
Absolutely. So I think it depends what kind of dance you do, but certainly in some of the sort of, you know, more technical practices. So, you know, let's take something like ballet. There's a codified movement, you know, set of movements. It's about 200 steps to learn in classical ballet. So you learn a technical vocabulary, sort of along that, you know, the sort of style of what you're doing. You learn to focus, discipline, calm, breathe. And it really focuses the mind and body. So, you know, that can be really helpful for people, and certainly was helpful for me as a way in. But in terms of the broader dance aspects, dance is very holistic. So it is body and mind connecting. So you're thinking all the time you're dancing, even though your movements might become habitual, you're still very cognitively aware. So you're thinking, you're focused, you're losing yourself in the moment quite often in that flow. But it's a very cognitive practice, is dancing, actually. So your body is moving. You can gain control, awareness, kinesthetic awareness of yourself and other people. It's a wonderful thing to do for individual self-esteem and achievement. You're learning something new, but also it's wonderful for creativity. So for creativity, you know, you can find yourself, you can find your voice, you can express, you can create, you can tell a story, or you can, you know, just put some movements together that make you feel good. So socially, it can be wonderful to connect with other people as a community and develop something together or on your own. Physically, of course, it's wonderful, as we said, posture, alignment, breathing, all of those sorts of things. And then cognitively as well. So you're thinking all the time about, you know, how to problem solve, how to construct movements, how to make your body do what you'd like it to do, you know, all sorts of things. So it's really broad benefits in dance and movement.
Yeah, it's really fascinating when you really do consider the mind and body benefits. And as you were saying, the social benefits are really key. And I also wondered if, in your case, were there any cultural challenges? Because, of course, not everybody can get, if you like, to the social benefits, because sometimes there's the cultural challenge. Perhaps dance isn't normative in that particular setting or family or community. It might even be class-based, like the famous Billy Elliot film showed all of us. And I wondered if you had any cultural challenges yourself.
So I guess, you know, I was probably quite lucky in that I, you know, was able to sort of access a local dance group or core centre and sort of work from there. But I guess what that privilege has given me is a real sort of access and opportunity to offering dance to many other audiences, many other people. So there are challenges and barriers for people to access dance in our society now, whether that is, you know, ballet or the more contemporary forms. So culturally, many people can dance in their culture and, you know, people grow up dancing. But in terms of, you know, having some teaching or training around that, often that there is a financial aspect to that. Often there's an economic aspect to that, and a lot of people can't afford to go to classes to have any technique, you know, whether that be dances rooted in the African diaspora, so sort of, you know, hip-hop classes or something like this, or whether it is contemporary or ballet or more kind of, you know, codified forms, whatever. So I think there is certainly some, you know, economic barriers, and that continues to be the case for many people. Many people would like to learn how to dance, but it can be very challenging to access that. So I think that is still a challenge in our society. There are things that have tried to break down some of those barriers. So we've had the Centre of Advanced Training that started in 2004, and that's a scheme to enable young people who might not have access to high quality training to get that from some of our conservatoires and so on. And there are bursaries that go with enabling people to do that. But sometimes those bursaries also have limits to them. So people can't always access as much as they'd like. And then more recently, there are some sort of wider schemes which are free. So, for example, I do some research with the Signet School, which is part of Matthew Bourne's New Adventures company. And for that scheme, it's completely free. So travel is all covered, food's covered, T-shirts are covered, you know, everything is covered there. And that reminds me of another program that I was able to be involved in, which was called Avanti, which is actually a Kent-based program here. And that was a program for young people who would come from, you know, challenging circumstances. So they may have been refugees or excluded from school for whatever reason. And we brought a group together that didn't know each other. And again, we did a sort of wraparound care version of an intervention, which meant that we actually had people picking up young people in a minibus, bringing them to the university to engage in some sort of intensive dance opportunities. And their experience obviously, you know, impacted socially, physically, emotionally, cognitively, but also culturally. So thinking about their opportunities to build some social capital, for example, you know, was a wonderful benefit from that. So so personally, I think I've had access points, but I am very, very aware that, you know, that isn't always the case for people. And that's what I'm trying to do in my work, really, you know, break down some of those barriers and challenges and really offer people opportunities to move, to dance, to engage with people, creative people who can spur creativity from other people, you know, and all of us to really enjoy that movement, creative opportunity that dance brings us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is really significant work that you're investing in, you know, personally and professionally. And actually, can we pop back to the Signet School? Because, of course, that's current work. And for listeners who may be new to the world of dance, it's worth just to add some context that Matthew Bourne, he's considered the UK's most successful choreographer and director. In fact, he's received a knighthood and he's also received the Queen Elizabeth II Coronation Award, which recognises his outstanding services to the art of ballet. And I just wanted to add that context in, Angela, because it's really important, isn't it, that the significance of people like yourselves with a wealth of experience and significant careers really understand the importance of creating positive change and especially diversity, diversifying who can participate in the arts, in ballet. I wondered if you could tell us more about the Signet School. I understand there's currently 15 students. I wondered if you could tell us about the diversity of their backgrounds and perhaps some of the impact that you're already seeing through this scheme.
Yes, so the Signet School started 3 years ago. This is its third year. And it really is a sort of grassroots opportunity linked to New Adventures' way of working. So New Adventures do have important technical underpinnings. So they do work in ballet and contemporary forms. But what's really exciting about New Adventures is probably why Matthew Bourne has been so popular, is that there is a wealth of creativity that comes from the work that they produce. One is the sort of subversion of the more kind of traditional tales that they tell, and the way that Matthew was able to make things relevant to a wide audience in that way. But the other thing that New Adventures do really well is sort of characterization and offering creative opportunities. And they really focus on the dancers that are in the room. So who have they got and what can those dancers bring to that performance, that creativity, that creation process? And so the Signet School started with all of the kind of New Adventures way of working in mind to try and help, one, close the gap because we've got less boys dancing than we'd like. So one of the aspects of that work was really to build the pipeline of boys coming through and men into dance. And that really started some time ago when the Lord of the Flies, Matthew Bourne performance came here in Kent. And that is one where often community are involved in that actual performance. And it was a challenge to find more kind of boys and men to engage with that. So it's a bit of a legacy coming from that. And then again, just looking at the pipeline of dancers that we'd really like to bring through in Kent. And so this training program began, an education program, I probably should say, actually, because it's much more than training. And 15 young people have been brought together, all from different backgrounds in terms of ethnicity, age. So they're between 13 and 18. We did have up to 25 for those with disability. We've got different gender represented and different economic backgrounds as well. So there's a nice mix of people within that group. And they are really fortunate, I think, to be taught by wonderful teaching artists. And other members of the company come and teach with them as well. And they have a nice support in terms of pastoral care as well. And they meet just once every month, so just on a Sunday every month. And then they also have a summer residency program where they perform at the end of that. So they create work that they perform to a wider audience. Now, what's been wonderful about working with that group, I feel really privileged to be part of that, is that I've been doing all of the kind of research and evaluation around that to inform the program as it develops. So we started with the pilot year, and the work that came out of that informed the first year. And we've moved on now to the kind of second year proper of the program. And some students have come in and out because some have gone on to university or other training programs, for example. But we've got a core group of people, and then new people come in, and they're brought in and supported through that kind of induction process. But during those Sundays, the young people get some technique classes, they play games together, they create, so they have lots of creative opportunities, they learn new adventures repertoire as well, they eat together, they chat together, and it's just a wonderful example of how one can build an enabling environment to really support young people in adolescence, where they're going through lots of different changes and they may be having other struggles beyond the sort of normal adolescent family groups and so on. And they are just such a wonderful socially, you know, beautiful community group who really do support and challenge each other to create really high quality work, you know, at a very high standard. And they do this through really getting to know each other very well. There's a wonderful way that they peer support and mentor each other, and they challenge each other, they help each other. So socially has been wonderful. And what's coming out of that is this real true sense of belonging, that they have an identity as a dancer, and they're building that identity as a dancer, but also as a young person. They're finding things that they have in common, but also things that are very different. And they're connecting with each other in that way. And again, the methodology, the pedagogy, the way that that kind of psychological approach is brought in as well, to making sure everybody feels safe in that space, psychologically safe. So it's a really enabling environment that's been developed there. So obviously, physically, technically, creatively, cognitively, problem solving, all of that kind of stuff's there. But the social stuff is really, really important, actually, particularly at this adolescent time. So although it might be hard for them to get up on a Sunday morning to go once a month, and they do have a long day together, it is really outstanding what they manage to do in that day. And similarly, in this summer program, the quality of what they produce, they're together for a whole week, they stay here in Kent, they stay in our halls of residence from the university. So again, you know, they have a wonderful time doing that too. And so I feel very, very privileged to be able to really be part of something that we feel has real potential to grow.
Yeah, I was really interested to hear about the emphasis on pastoral care. I think it's so important for so many reasons. Obviously, just the general context today, you know, in terms of cost of living crisis, the pandemic crisis, you know, mental health and anxiety in general is a significant and escalated problem. But also in the context of engaging young people that are from a range of backgrounds that may be economically disadvantaged or, as you said, different ethnicities, there's always a struggle, isn't there, where you may feel othered, for example, but you are now in a space that is embracing diversity. It's creating a space of equality. But at the same time, there are challenges. And I'm wondering what kind of things you're hearing these participants say from that social point of view, the positive impact this is making. I'm wondering if you've even heard anything that may have surprised you in the most positive way.
I think what's also wonderful about this particular scheme, if you like, is that the young people get access to seeing that work on stage. So they actually get tickets for the New Adventures productions as well. And just Saturday night, in fact, we brought together the young people, but also a parent or carer from each of the young people as well. And so for some of them, parents, for some of the parents or carers, that might have been the first time they were able to go to the theatre to see a full production of one of the Matthew Bourne's pieces. And so what we're doing is we're broadening, you know, opportunities, audiences, access, whereas some people might not have thought, you know, the theatre was for them. They might not have thought that Matthew Bourne's work was for them. You know, they realise when they're watching that actually it's so magical and so engaging and accessible that, you know, we've had quite a few comments from the parents and carers actually saying, wow, you know, this was the first time I've done this and it's really, really wonderful. And similarly, the young people, you know, they wouldn't necessarily be able to afford ticket prices to go and see things, but we're giving them those opportunities. And again, that really is part of the methodology of Matthew Bourne's work, that he wants it to be accessible. He wants so many people to be involved and to widen those audiences and to make it relevant for people. And so I think that's been, you know, one of the wonderful outcomes, that those barriers that might have excluded are actually including a little bit more now. And in terms of those, you know, young people, there is something about that sense of belonging that's really important. So in that studio space, it's a very different studio space to maybe a classroom that you might find in school or even a school dance session, in fact, because the young people are given autonomy to a certain extent. You know, there's lots of opportunities for them to make decisions and to co-create, co-design, develop things for themselves, create their own kind of solo group work, that kind of thing. There is this belonging that is fostered from the moment they come into the space. You know, we chat to them about, you know, how their journey was, how they're feeling. We do a check-in to see, you know, if there's anything we need to know, particularly all those sorts of things. And then there's also this sort of notion of competence. So everybody is seen from a positive point of view, a can-do point of view, so that everyone is achieving and developing. And it's all about, you know, them feeling as though they are, you know, they have worth and value. So again, it's sort of breaking down the barriers that dance is not for everyone, because it really is in this case. And even if, you know, things become challenging, so maybe they're trying to learn something and it's challenging, you know, everyone's working through, and we find ways, we find different strategies to help them problem solve. And, you know, and there are times where they can just sit out for a bit or chill out for a bit, or, you know, there's a lot of humour in the room, as I say. So, you know, there's never a kind of strict atmosphere where people feel worried to speak. You know, there's lots of opportunities for questions and voice. So that's what I mean by an enabling environment. I think that's really come out, particularly from this particular program.
Yeah, yeah. And such rare opportunities, but such significant and important opportunities. And it's all part of, if you like, literally changing the stage. I'm really interested as well in, huge stories of self-empowerment as well. So, for example, Ballet Black, the founder, Casa Poncho, has done incredible work. And again, just to offer some context for listeners, I was reading how it was only, in fact, 20 years ago when she herself was only 21. And as part of her own thesis research, where she wanted to research Black women in ballet, was basically confronted with the fact that there was no one she could really go to. And it led to her founding Ballet Black. And, 20 years later, she's made significant inroads. I think she currently has 9, possibly 10 members of the ballet. But isn't it incredible that Ballet Black was founded 20 years ago? And actually, there's also really fascinating history in terms of the American dancer and choreographer, Catherine Dunham, who was also, a dancer and social activist, and was also changing the stage. So Catherine was bringing in dance movement styles, if you like, that would have embraced African, Caribbean and South American dance cultures. And in the 1930s and 40s, Catherine was also opening her schools and had also already founded the first Black ballet dance company in the USA. What fascinates me is there are these huge stories of self-empowerment and social change, and in this very broad timeline spanning from the 1930s to Ballet Black being founded in 2001 and to this really significant work you're currently doing with Matthew Bourne. Yet doesn't it show that for some reason change is slow in terms of how the stage embraces diversity in a way that's simply normal?
Yes, absolutely. So I think it's worth mentioning now the first British Black professional ballerina, who was Julie Felix. She's recently got an MBE, I think. So she's a mixed race dancer, Black father from St. Lucia, white British mother. And she also had to overcome quite a lot of racism and discrimination, but pushed through to want to be part of the ballet world. So I've just developed a dance educators network called Critical Dance Pedagogy through Discourse and Practice, particularly for these reasons. So although we do have more representation within the dance sector now, there is still marginalized voices. There are still underserved communities. There are still many, many people who would love to dance but don't have access, opportunities, visibility, all of those things. So we're talking about, all kind of equity, diversity, inclusion in this way. So this new dance educators network, Critical Dance Pedagogy, it's really examining these sort of taken for granted assumptions that exist in dance. And from that, it is about, which bodies are profiled, which bodies are accepted to be in the space, and which bodies are excluded. And we still do have quite a lot of exclusion rather than inclusion, even in the contemporary forms. If you want to work professionally, there's still more that can be done across the whole of the sector. And so we've got these sort of dominant stereotypes. And we've also got particular education and studio structures that can also be quite excluding. So this is what we're really looking at within this network. And it's a UK-wide network, but it's also got partners from the US and from Nordic countries as well. And we're hoping that it will grow to become more of an international development as well. But what we're trying to challenge is this kind of reproduction of hierarchies, positions and capitals, barriers, exclusions, social inequalities. So we're really trying to challenge that as a group to offer more opportunities. So this is really around the kind of professional dance sector and the education sector. Now, of course, in contrast, we've got a huge participatory sector, which is more around dance for health, dance for well-being. And in this sector, actually, it's very inclusive, very open. And there's lots of evidence now to show us that dancing, you know, with, you know, whether you're very young or whether you're much older, is very, very good for our health and well-being. It has, you know, huge amounts of health and well-being benefits. So it's really interesting how, you know, we've got this sort of, you can dance if it's for kind of health and well-being, and there's lots of opportunities around that. But there's less opportunities for the kind of more professional sector. So it could be said that people who might want to go and dance for health and well-being benefits might not do that. They might not feel the dance is for them, maybe because they haven't really had the visibility, they haven't seen dance around them, they haven't had opportunities in that way. So there's lots to be done, really, in this area to kind of close that gap between the sort of professional educational work and the health and well-being benefits, to really show, you know, that dance can change our lives, dance can make a difference to us, and everybody should be kind of moving, whether it is kind of somatically or whether it is more technically. Or more creatively. So that's really why we sort of developed this network.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting, because it does seem very clear that there are so many things to still confront in terms of barriers and structural barriers. And actually, having just mentioned Casa Poncho of Ballet Black, one quote of hers that stood out, and Casa is also of mixed heritage. Her father's from Trinidad and her mother's from the UK. And she's always felt like a witness to prejudice, in terms of she, in fact, has often not been perceived as being a person of Black heritage herself, maybe Mediterranean, for example. And so she's often heard comments that would never normally be made. But one overt comment was being told Black people only want to do hip hop. So the level of stereotyping, assumptions, structural barriers, it's a lot of unraveling, isn't it? A lot of confronting in the most positive sense in order to change these barriers of entry to dance.
Absolutely. So what tends to happen in society is a sort of perpetuating of social norms and expectations. And it's only when you disrupt that, that you can make change. You can start evolving. Now, I think it's possible. I'm very optimistic that, you know, we can continue to evolve, we continue to learn, and we continue to change. Be, you know, more open and tolerant in society, and that's, you know, more kind of broad. Because there is a lot of prejudice, there is a lot of racism, there is a lot of fear around difference. And that is something that, you know, we need to work on as a society. And so in my very small way, I'm trying to make a difference by challenging some of those social norms and expectations, encouraging others to challenge those norms and expectations. And, you know, again, just trying to make a difference where I can. But one of my favorite philosophers, it seems odd to kind of bring him in here, but it's Pierre Bourdieu. And I think he kind of really helps me understand why we do perpetuate these social norms and expectations. And it is to do with power. And so Pierre Bourdieu speaks about the notion of social capital. So how you can build your power, really. And social capital, there are other sorts of capital. So, for example, there would be physical capital. That would be, you know, a really nice one to show power. There's economic capital, of course, you know, things like this. But basically, in order to understand how you can use your power or build your power, you have to understand the rules of the game. And for some people, if you're not given access and opportunity to even, you know, step into the game, then you're not going to be able to build the power and understand the rules of the game. And of course, those people that are in the game are manipulating the game and perpetuating those rules of the game. So what I'm trying to do is sort of disrupt a little bit and change the rules.
Yeah, good for you.
And that's, you know, there's a wonderful person, Naiama McCarthy, who talks about culturally responsive pedagogy. And she talks about that. She says, you know, what are you going to change? What are you going to let go of? You know? And I think, you know, sometimes we don't realize what we take for granted. And these taken for granted assumptions, these stereotypes, it all needs to be challenged. And so this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to disrupt the norms in my work.
Yeah. And it reminds me of a quote I made a note of from Matthew Bourne, who was talking about risks that face dance today. And he said, if you don't move with the times and you don't excite the young, then it could be a dying form. And in terms of what you were just saying, positive disruption, I'm wondering what you would say moving with the times looks like.
Yeah. So moving with the times is, I think, again, challenging norms and expectations that, you know, we have a wealth of creativity in human beings. You know, there is so much potential to create amazing work from people. People have huge amounts of embodiment they can bring, you know, cultural identity, experiences of the world, you know, emotional aspects, whether they are positive or more negative, kind of crystallizing experiences that have made them, you know, challenge or be curious or have courage to do something. You know, there's a wealth of opportunity there. And I think what Matthew perhaps is saying that, you know, we do need to be able to give opportunities to connect with different people and see different people on the stage and have representation and see what people bring, because huge amounts of, as I say, embodiment, cultural diversity, experience of the world, you know, there's lots and lots of opportunity there for us. So I think, you know, we want to see a range of things going forward. The challenges that theatres have got to take a risk sometimes to take on new work, whether that be from sort of early career choreographers, for example, or artists who are still experimenting with their work and need an audience, need a forum, need a critique, or whether it is those sort of bigger companies that perhaps they haven't seen before. Sometimes theatre have got to take a risk and realise that, you know, we've got to sometimes educate audiences as well to be open to new things, because again, sometimes if you see the same thing on the stage, that perpetuates what you think you like. You know, if you're not given opportunity to see other things that might challenge yourself and your thinking, and, you know, maybe educate you about things. So I think that's why it's really important. So one of the other projects I'm doing is Little Big Dance, which again is really thinking about very young children and starting to expose very young children to contemporary dance and working with different artists. And they actually co-create the work with these artists as well. So very young children under five are involved in a creative dance process where they're co-creating work with dance artists and choreographers and co-designing that work that goes forward for production. And then theatres are commissioning that work, and that's been shown, and that's been very, very successful. So really starting very, very young to really push the boundaries for the artists as well, because the artist might have an idea and the children might, you know, select or reject that. And so really the artists are being educated by very, very young children. So that's just another example where we can start, you know, really diversifying practice and not necessarily just thinking, you know, we're the ones that are going to be involved in that practice.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting because there's a strong case, isn't there, for dance to be included as an important part of a school curriculum, as you say, starting at an early age. But of course, unfortunately, provision today at state schools for the arts is very, very poor. There have been systematic cuts. So I'm wondering, whilst you can see there is that clear case, there's those benefits, for example, that healthy openness, that curiosity of the mind, in terms of what you were saying at the beginning, learning discipline, learning stillness, in fact, is all as important as those physical benefits. But what would you say are the correlations that are perhaps not better understood in terms of dance and well-being translating into wider positive results in education?
So as I said sort of at the start when we were talking about my own background, I think dance is very cognitive. You know, you're thinking all the time in dance, but what it does well is because you're connecting the body and mind, it's very inclusive in that way, because for, you know, all of us, we need to move. And unfortunately, in our education system at the moment, right from, you know, very young children up to our, you know, secondary, there's a lot of being rooted to one place in terms of how you're educated. So, you know, often very young children are rooted to seats for long periods of time. And similarly in secondary, you know, there's an awful lot of curriculum to cover. And there's an awful lot, you know, that they learn often in a kind of seated position. Whereas with dance and with movement, you know, to move, it's as the physical benefits, of course, you know, there is opportunities to build fitness. There is opportunities for strength and conditioning. There's opportunities for coordination and control, all of those sorts of things. So there's the physical health benefits where you've got what you might have with other, you know, sports, for example, or gymnastics, you know, you have those benefits. But what's different about dance is you're getting wider benefits. So you're connecting body and mind because you're having to think. You're having to think beyond what you might do in a sports relationship. For example, of course, you're thinking about different tactics or something like this. But if you're developing creativity, if you're developing, you know, a way of making a solo piece of work, let's say, you're thinking like you might think in terms of constructing an essay. So you're thinking about how you're going to, what's your idea, how you're going to construct your idea. And, you know, in terms of words, what movements are you going to be using? How are you going to punctuate those movements? So, you know, as we might have commas or full stops, how you might structure that movement in some way, how you might have a beginning, middle and end of some sort. How are you going to really engage with the audience? How are you going to meaning make? All of those things come through dance experiences in the more creative way. If you're connecting with other people, again, you're working together, you're problem solving, you're trying to make something together. So there is the social, but also, as I say, the cognitive aspect with that sort of trying to engage with who's going to lead, who's going to follow. How are you going to articulate what you might do together, you know, in words or non-verbal? So, dance for me is a hugely important part of the curriculum because it does offer, you know, as I say, the sort of physical, social, emotional, cultural benefits as well, because people can share their experiences of the world through their creativity and through each other. And there's also huge amounts of, you know, as I say, group working, leadership, articulation, And that can have a benefit in the classroom as well with other subjects, you know, in the way that you think and learn.
Absolutely. And all of those skills that you've identified and the significant research that's being undertaken at the Sydney De Haan Centre really speaks to an absolutely wonderful, it's one of my most favourite documentaries, and I know I've mentioned it to you in a previous chat, is Mad Hot Ballroom. So for the listeners, Mad Hot Ballroom was shot in America in 2005. You can still find it online. And it's absolutely fantastic. Just to give this example, because it really speaks to everything you've just said. This was a documentary that involved children in New York at three different schools. And there were all sorts of different social deprivations and backgrounds. And ballroom dancing was introduced. And from the outset, that could have just looked almost too ridiculous for words. But the transformative process of introducing ballroom dancing to these children was absolutely phenomenal. It's joyous and it absolutely transformed their confidence and their wider outcomes, and their results in other subjects were all climbing. Everything was improving. And I think it was really that social impact that you've been consistently referring to that was really, really transformative in this. All the lovely etiquette that was involved, all of the pastoral care that was involved, that actually you matter, we care about this, we want you to do well in this dance competition, the nice clothes that go on, the fact that you're leading your partner onto the dance floor, and also the courage involved, you know, competitive dancing or even just entering the space of dance is asking for a lot of courage. And I really felt this documentary just summed all of these benefits up brilliantly and is as relevant today and with all of the important research you're doing today.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, dance is certainly around health and well-being. One of the biggest aspects of the work that we've done in the centre is around, again, the sort of sense of belonging, cohesion, community, identity development that can be transformative for people. So some of the projects we do there are around different groups of people. So, for example, we did a project with older groups. So we did a project with older people who had had a fall or were at risk of having a fall. Now, when an older person has a fall, it can really disrupt their day-to-day life and dent their confidence considerably. So often they have a long recovery period and they tend to be given two kinds of physiotherapy methods to do at home. One is called FAME for people who have, less problems with their fall, and one is called Ontargo. People don't tend to want to do those at home because they're quite boring. They're sort of given a little sheet and they have to cover these exercises. So what we did was take these sort of exercises, these physiotherapy methods, and we integrated them into a creative dance program. And then we brought the older people into community centres and brought dance artists in. And we put together creative dance sessions with the groups and integrated these physiotherapy methods. And so people were getting kind of stronger and fitter and more flexible and more stable without kind of realising, because they were really enjoying themselves through creative dance. Now, one of the biggest outcomes of that was it really reduced loneliness, because some of the older people were getting very lonely and very bored and really did not have confidence to kind of move about on their own and things like this and didn't go out. And so this sort of program just gave them a new lease of life. And there were, you know, huge amounts of joy in the room, you know, each time we went to these sessions. So reducing loneliness is another way, you know, again, this community connection. You know, of course, it had the wraparound with a cup of tea and whatever. And they just loved coming. And so there was a, you know, a great commitment there from people to really come and enjoy this Dance to Health program. So that's one example of where, you know, dance can be transformative. It can really change someone's life from feeling very lonely to having this kind of dynamic change in their life. And then again, feeling, you know, much more stable in the way that they could move around.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I think another example is we're just starting a program with some survivors of domestic abuse. Now, Laura Kenyon has been running this with groups of dancers who are professional dancers, but have had experiences of domestic abuse. And we're going to be rolling this out with wider populations of people who are survivors of domestic abuse and using dance as a way of really expressing some of that kind of traumatic experience, but then, you know, utilizing that for creative aspects and building people's confidence and identity and value again. And so that's another project that's coming soon, which we're really excited about.
Yeah. And I know that you can see online at the moment examples of this work with the artistic director, Laura Kenyon. And I really do encourage people to take a look, because this space of dance responding to something as traumatic as domestic violence, for example, is so important because, of course, dance or the arts in general have such a significant role in terms of trauma and being able to either express that trauma or even to just simply start approaching trauma in order to start recovering.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, talking therapies doesn't work for everybody. You know, sometimes people don't want to face some of those things in through words. Sometimes they do. I mean, you know, poetry, for example, is a way where they can face those things through words without talking therapies as such. But I think what dance and, you know, broader arts opportunities, whether that's, you know, drawing, sculpture, fine art, theatre, whatever it might be, they do offer a forum for people to explore at their own pace, to examine some of these really challenging moments in life, and then to make choices about what they really want to investigate for themselves. And in doing that, you know, we can offer a safe space, a forum that is, you know, carefully constructed, an enabling environment where people can, you know, take small steps or big strides, whatever, you know, whatever is helpful, and we will help them, you know, begin to come to terms with or accept or move forward or become or evolve, you know, as kind of a new person through this experience of support and challenge to create something that can be expressive, can be kind of very big and bold, or can be very small and simple and insular, but it makes huge meaning to that person and, you know, can really, again, be transformative and helpful if done in the right way. So, you know, I really believe in that way, dance and, you know, movement practices, opportunities like that can be life-changing, can be transformative.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting when we reflect on the idea of the courage that's involved when we want to change our own lives or heal or have to face certain things, or even just to simply choose to be a performer. And of course, there are other struggles and difficulties, and your book certainly addresses the risks that dancers can face in terms of unnatural demands, if you like, particularly going back to the idea of body expectations. And I know that you've written about eating disorders, pain, anxiety, addiction, and even post-traumatic stress disorder can be part of the dance world, or perhaps more specifically, the ballet world. There's a huge struggle, in fact, between courage and conflict. And I wondered how you see those areas being addressed today, those unhealthy demands, if you like, on professional dancers.
Yeah, so this work was a work where I tracked young dancers as they were becoming dancers. It was a longitudinal study, and it looked at all of the aspects of becoming a dancer, particularly a ballet dancer. And I still have some of those young dancers who were involved in that early study that I'm still in touch with, and I've tracked them through to see how they've developed in their profession. So I think, you know, in terms of the sort of ballerina stereotype, it does represent these sort of social cultural representations and contradictions, really. So, you know, on the one hand, the ballerina is, it sort of demonstrates artistry, technical mastery, strength. Ballet is an area where women dominate as dancers and teachers, actually. And it's well funded, you know, becoming part of a company is huge. Kudos, you get, you know, multiple support teams around you, making sure that you thrive. But on the other hand, ballet is quite restrictive, and there's a limitation because it is quite technically driven. So that creativity is not so much now, because there are much more subversions of ballets and more creativity coming through. But it can be quite restrictive and technically driven. And sometimes ballet dancers lack agency. So traditional ballet methods are quite authoritarian in sort of ballet teaching. And so, you know, the ballet dancer isn't really supposed to question. And there are particular physical and mental demands on ballet dancers. So, you know, there is an expectation of particular ballet body size, shape. And that does bring with it some risks, some tensions, some challenge, some pressures. And so there is evidence from the studies that I've undertaken, that study that I've mentioned and others. As in other ascetic sports, actually, as well. So when you have, you know, a big focus on aesthetics and particular size, shape of bodies and so on, that can have an impact on people whose bodies maybe don't fit, and or they don't feel that they fit. So in terms of mental illness, you know, that can be a challenge. So yes, there, you know, there can be a prevalence of eating disorders and vulnerabilities and risk to eating disorder, because there is, you know, a mirror constantly magnifying, and there's scrutiny of the body, you know, very much within the ballet world. However, I would say that there are some changes. You know, ballet companies, ballet schools are much more mindful of these areas, and they are developing, you know, much more kind of healthy dancer programs, and really thinking about some of those difficult circumstances from, you know, quite a young age with ballet dancers coming through that training program. So there is some work happening there, and I'm pleased to be involved in some of that. So that's been great. You'll know that we recently had the Panorama program that talked about some of those historical things, you know, some bullying and some, you know, some quite uncomfortable areas. So it's disappointing that, you know, that there's still evidence of that. It's going to take a long time to change, because as I say, there are these sort of social norms and expectations. We've got to disrupt them. People have got to feel they have agency and voice within that. And the training programs in the traditional form doesn't really give a forum for that. So that's very much what I've been interested in as well, is sort of disrupting that to make things much more kind of healthy for longevity in the profession as well.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And in terms of the network you mentioned earlier, you know, in terms of addressing all sorts of issues facing structural barriers in the dance world. In season five, I had the privilege to interview Gregory McComa, who is considered a legend as a dancer and a choreographer. And he lived under the South African apartheid system for the first 21 years of his life. So he is an outstanding person in terms of how he survived some of the cruelest and most overt barriers of discrimination to become who he is today. But of course, his dance company is all about the fact that we are all different shapes and sizes, everything that you were speaking to, and the importance of recognizing that and embracing that. And in fact, I should introduce you perhaps for your network, because, you know, his insights, his experience is invaluable. And also, he's the mentor to Musa Mota, also interviewed in season five, that some listeners may know was a finalist on Britain's Got Talent for his outstanding dance performance, despite having a leg amputated at the age of 11. So I'm highlighting these examples partly because it's so relevant to your work, and hopefully I can make some introductions. But also, it's such important testimony, isn't it? That of course dance belongs to everybody. Of course it shouldn't be dictated by certain body types.
Absolutely. So I think, as I say, I mean, we have had, you know, huge amounts of changes over the years, where we do have, you know, companies like Kanduko, for example, who really profile disability within their work. And as you've mentioned, you know, we've had some challenges with some of the prejudices in terms of race. So there have been subversions, there have been disruptions, there have been, you know, wonderful things happening in the sector. But there's room for more. And I think this is why it's really important to keep challenging those norms, expectations and stereotypes, you know, disrupt the sort of practice that can perpetuate quite deep sort of, you know, illness and trauma and so on. And you know, open our doors and become, you know, much more inclusive, much more equitable, much more diverse. And I think, you know, this is, again, something I'm really passionate about.
It's absolutely fascinating what your work and your research is doing. And I'm hugely conscious we've raced through our hour, and there's so many interesting things to talk about. So I should certainly move on to the closing question before making a couple of additional comments. And of course, that's what your thoughts are on the series question. Can art save us? Or should I say, can dance save us? Or does one dance a day keep the doctor away?
Absolutely. So yes, I think dance can save us. I think when we dance together, we get to know each other. And that's really important in society. So all of those prejudices, fears, stereotypes, they all go out the window when you're actually in a studio with people, or in a nightclub, or wherever you are, or at a party, and you're dancing together, you get to know each other, and all those barriers come down. So yes, I think arts can save us. It can make us a much more inclusive society, and it can make us a more tolerant society.
It's been so lovely having this time with you today. I can't thank you enough, because it's really bringing to the fore that dance obviously has multiple benefits, and it really does need to almost be returned to the people, that it's something that is all of ours. And I think that maybe we need to think of Dr. Angela Pickard, formerly known as Squiggle. As someone who still today has significant energy, just as much as when you were a young toddler entering the world of dance, because it does take this huge amount of energy and commitment, doesn't it, to literally change the stage, the dance stage. And what we're really talking about is changing those deep structural barriers and inequalities. And it's hugely impressive to hear about the range of work you're doing at the Sydney Dehaene Centre. So thank you very much for your time today.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.